Mark Brewer as former chair of the Michigan Democratic Party. Jeff Timmer as former executive director of the Michigan Republicans. And this is a Republic, if you can keep it, with Mark Brewer and Jeff Timmer.
I'm Jeff Timmer. Thanks for joining us this week on A Republic, If You Can Keep It. Later in the podcast, we'll talk with former U.S. Attorney for Southeast Michigan, Barb McQuaid.
And I'm Mark Brewer. We begin, as always, with some legitimate political discourse about the politics of the week. And Jeff, I just say I'm dying to ask you your take on the latest entry into the Republican gubernatorial sweepstakes, this Perry Johnson, who dropped over $1 million into a Super Bowl ad and then followed up with a massive statewide TV buy. What do you think?
It seems that Perry Johnson has more money than sense. The playbook, it's not exactly revolutionary what they're trying to do. It's trying to recreate the Rick Snyder 2010 campaign. He's got the same people involved in plotting and executing the campaign. He's wealthy, self-funding outsider with no political connections, kind of trying to, you know, recreate whatever lightning that caused Rick Snyder to win that primary against a seasoned field of candidates, one who had been elected statewide and one who had been in Congress for a long time. Where it seems to fall flat to me is the circumstances in the climate in which he's running is just entirely different. Johnson trying to play up this quality guru background of his as if that means anything to anybody. What worked for Rick Snyder in people who were around Michigan politics, and a lot of people who weren't even from Michigan knew this one tough nerd thing that with it was so quirky and weird and self-deprecating that it stood out and was kind of in its way endearing and made him stand out. I don't know that there's in my years of political campaigning and marketing that I've heard anybody, you know, say, hey, you know what we really need? We need some guru. We need a quality guru. It just doesn't see it. They're trying to sell something that nobody's ever thought of buying before. It's Rick Snyder 2.0 without Rick Snyder. it took the self-deprecating quirkiness of Rick Snyder. What the vibe from watching Perry Johnson's announcement is more self-aggrandizing strangeness. There's just something a little off-putting, and that's kind of not just my take. You know, watching my Facebook feed, which has a lot of Republicans and politicos in it, but also a lot of civilians, the vibe is he's just kind of odd. He seems strange. He seems full of himself. He seems weird. He looks weird. And okay, fair or unfair, people's reactions, those emotional reactions, and first reactions, those first impressions are kind of hard to overcome if they're not good. And right now, it doesn't seem that those first impressions have been very good.
Jeff, let me hone in on something specifically that he did. I mean, you're a very experienced political operative in this state. You know, dropping $1.5 million on a Super Bowl ad and then going on a spending spree in the media like he did, is that the best use of his money?
It's the best use of a campaign consultant wanting to make sure he gets his money up front. I don't think there's any strategic value to doing something like that. To spend that kind of money on a Super Bowl ad just doesn't. I mean, it got some news. I think all the major newspapers did a story on the fact that he was running the ad, so there was value beyond the initial ad and the cost. It wasn't Rick Snyder didn't win the nomination in 2010 because he ran a Super Bowl ad. he won the nomination then largely because two established traditional politicians, Mike Cox, the Attorney General, and Pete Hoekstra, longtime congressman, and then Mike Bouchard, the Oakland County Sheriff, was in the race too. But really, it was Cox and Hoekstra spent the time between January and August of 2010 beating each other's brains out, paying no attention to Rick Snyder until about the middle of July before the primary, when all of a sudden he started to move in polls. The two frontrunners did a great job of disqualifying each other and created that perfect storm for Rick Snyder and his money to kind of surge at the last minute and win. I don't see where that dynamic comes from for Perry Johnson. Now, you could make the argument, okay, he's got a bunch of nobodies with no political base running, but he does have another self-funder who seems maybe a little more regular guy, unpolished, a little more real, Kevin Rinke. And not that I think that he's a good candidate. He started his campaign with a lot of flaws and a lot of negative publicity about racist and misogynist lawsuits in his past with his business. And so Johnson has to contend with somebody who has the capacity to maybe spend with him. So he doesn't have that Rick Snyder lane. Okay, I can just outspend everybody. I could see a circumstance where you get Johnson and Rinke kind of disqualifying each other with their money and creating an opportunity for a Giordano or a Tudor Dixon, who was down at Mar-a-Lago recently, and maybe the surprise of 2022 on the Republican side, where somebody who is more of a grassroots candidate without a lot of money has that. It's kind of the reverse Snyder that could happen. The self-funders beat each other's brains out in kind of the roles as Cox and Hoekstra, allowing the grassroots low money candidate to sneak up the middle. And I'm not saying that's likely to happen, but it could happen. And if it does, then we can point back to, February of 2022 when I predicted it.
Well, thanks for all that. Let's talk about another issue, which is really starting to emerge as an issue that cuts across all these races. And that's the issue of abortion. You know, it's widely believed that the United States Supreme Court is either going to overrule Roe versus Wade or significantly cut back on it in a case that's got pending out of Mississippi. And that would, I think, set off a real political earthquake. I mean, we've seen for years Right to Life and others, campaigning against the right to choose, against abortion, succeeding apparently in getting a U.S. Supreme Court that agrees with them. But it's kind of like, what's the old adage about the dog that caught the car? They may be about to catch the car. And I think they may be very surprised by what happens, because there are a lot of people in this state and nationally who believe in the right to choose and haven't been particularly motivated to vote on that basis because it's been secure, right? Because Roe versus Wade has been the law. If Roe disappears, that could really insert this issue of abortion into political races across the spectrum and may mobilize voters who weren't mobilized by that issue in the past. What's your take on what abortion, the issue of abortion, what role it could play this year?
Well, I think it could be seismic and game changing. And we've talked about it on this podcast before, that even voters and sometimes politicians who call themselves pro-life, when it comes to the issue, the possibility of criminalizing of women, girls, doctors, of your wife, of your sister, of your daughter, being prosecuted for terminating a pregnancy, that's a bridge too far for a lot of people, not for all, but for a lot of people. And this is really a circumstance now where it puts the Republican politicians far outside the mainstream of where voters are, even pro-life voters. Poll after poll shows this. It's not even close. There's no woulda, coulda, shoulda when it comes to where people stand on Roe versus Wade being overturned. It's like nearly 80% of voters in Michigan want to preserve and protect Roe, and they don't want to see abortion criminalized. And that includes a majority of Republicans.
Well, it's amazing, though, to me that just this week, we're going even beyond that. I mean, one, I think it was Saldana, one of the Republican candidates for governor this week, said no exception for rape.
Well, and Johnson said that in his scrum after his announcement.
Right.
And so, yeah, we have at least two of the Republican candidates who have gone on record saying no exception for rape, incest, the only exception being life of the mother. And that's just so far outside the norm that it's not even, you know, it's an apples to rutabagas kind of comparison to where most of the voters are. But that kind of near Taliban orthodoxy of many of the Republicans, it's not an abortion issue, but last week at a debate between the three candidates running for attorney general, all three of them said that they would overturn Griswold v. Connecticut, which was a 1965 Supreme Court decision that outlawed states. In 1965, there were states that had on the books laws that could prosecute and put you in jail if you used birth control, if you used condoms, if you used birth control pills. You could have been prosecuted and put in jail. And all three of these Republicans who are running for attorney general, the top law enforcement officer in the state, said that they would overturn that decision. And that could make it illegal for you to use birth control. That's nuts. I mean, that's just crazy. And that's where so much of the mainstream of Republican candidates are, not necessarily where the wide swath of Republican voters are. And that's why there's been such a disconnect in so many suburban and exurban areas with, you know, especially college-educated white voters, college-educated white women who have traditionally voted Republican, who never will again. And if we see candidates saying no exception for rape and incest, and oh, we're going to criminalize your birth control pills, that is going to make sure that generations of women never again vote Republican.
And the reason they're saying that, Jeff, isn't because, you know, they got this endorsement convention coming up, which is going to be controlled by, you know, a few thousand grassroots activists, and these candidates believe that that's what they have to say to get their support, and they're probably right. They are probably right in terms of how they're reading those delegates at convention. But as you pointed out in so many contexts before, how do you say that repeatedly, publicly? You get the nomination, and then how do you run a general election when you have taken such an extreme position? I mean, way beyond, you know, abortion. You know, a lot of people do believe in the right to choose. You can look at the different polling data, but the right to use contraception without being criminalized, that's got to be in the 90s in terms of people wanting that right, that ability. And to say that we're going to turn the clocks back to the 1950s and criminalize it, I you're right. People are just going to say, I don't use this word very often. You're bonkers. You are bonkers suggesting that.
Sure. I mean, you know, the whole imagery of the Handmaid Tale, you know, the women in the red robes with the white bonnets on, like on the TV show, it is very, very close to where these people are in their position. In fact, there's no breathing room in between that dystopian portrayal on TV and where these Republican candidates for governor and attorney general are. And that really, okay, they can win the battle. They can win the convention fight. They can win the primary. But I don't see how candidates like that can win the war of getting a majority of Michigan voters in November to side with them when their positions are so far outside what, you know, the vast majority of Michigan voters would consider sane.
Yeah, and now that this issue's been raised in the attorney general's race, it's not going to take long for it to come up in the governor's race, right? And we're going to have all these Republican candidates for governor asked about the same issue. And, you know, we'll have to see how that plays out. And we've still got, what, more than a month to go until the Republican endorsement convention?
Yeah, nearly 2 months. And, you know, the logic that the candidate, the salaciousness of, you know, getting involved in people's bedrooms and deciding what kind of birth control they can use, that's clearly, you know, government overreach in just about anybody's mind. But the argument that they're using isn't, they're claiming it's a state's rights issue. It's not up to the federal government to decide these kinds of things. It should be left to each state. Well, that logic would mean that decisions like Brown versus the Board of Education that desegregated schools, upholding the Voting Rights Act of 1964, 65, whatever it was, that Mississippi should have been able to prevent Black people from voting. That's their logic. And so that's the natural progression of their legal philosophy. These guys running for attorney general. If that's where the Republicans want to position themselves for this campaign, is being ready to overturn a case like Griswold versus Connecticut, that means they're also in favor of overturning cases like Brown versus the Board of Education or Loving versus Virginia, which was a interracial marriage. Virginia had outlawed interracial marriage, a lot of states had. And so you can't say my philosophy is this is a state's rights issue, but only on this issue, but not on that issue. So it's either your philosophy or it's not. And so this is case law that's been decided for, 50, 60, 70 years in many cases or longer. And, it's not exaggeration to say the Republicans are really trying to turn back the clock, well into the last century, if not the century before.
Before we turn to our guest, though, I want to talk about one more aspect of this. We now recently had unveiled a proposed ballot question for reproductive freedom. It's broader than abortion, but it does include abortion. A petition drive to put that on the ballot this fall and to make it part of the Michigan Constitution, that there would be a right to choose in the Michigan Constitution. And if that gets on the ballot, it seems to me this issue is going to be even, if it's possible, even more unavoidable. All these candidates are going to be asked for their position on that proposal. And this, from the top of the ticket all the way down through legislative races, congressional races, and so forth. And it's just going to be very, very difficult to avoid having abortion be one of the big issues this year.
Yeah, assuming that gets onto the ballot, it almost doesn't matter what happens with Roe. I mean, certainly if the Supreme Court overturns Roe, that's a game changer. If they leave Roe in place, the fact that this question is going to be before the voters, that there's going to be a lot of money spent for and against the passage of this constitutional amendment, will create myths that Roe may be overturned regardless of what happens at the Supreme Court level. Right now, the campaigns are not focusing on abortion being a major issue. They're focusing on COVID and they're focusing on the economy and they're saving democracy or Ukraine, all these issues that are screaming at us today. But I think by the time we get to the fall, abortion is going to be front and center and it's going to be unavoidable in for Michigan candidates. It's going to decide a lot of these races.
Yeah, that already though, Governor Whitmer and the Attorney General have been very outspoken on this issue. Attorney General Nessel has repeatedly said that if this Michigan has a criminal statute, which is currently unenforceable because of Roe, but if Roe goes away, that criminal statute comes back into effect. And she has repeatedly said that she will not enforce that law. And so those two statewide candidates have already been very out front on this issue. And that may serve them well if this comes to pass in the fall.
Yeah, I don't think there's going to be any ambiguity between the Democrat candidate's position and the Republican candidate's position on issues like abortion and maybe not contraception. And so I think that's going to draw a very clear, distinct line that has nothing to do with some of these national issues that's going to separate Michigan perhaps from whatever is happening nationally. I'm not going to say for certain that Michigan's going to buck any trend if there's if Democrats are, facing some kind of headwind nationally. The Republicans in Michigan seem to be doing what they can to take what could be an advantage year for them and turn it into, snatch defeat from the jaws of victory.
Former U.S. Attorney for Southeast Michigan, Barbara McQuaid, joins the conversation after these messages on A Republic If You Can Keep It.
Epic MRA is a Lansing-based market research and public opinion polling firm with nearly four decades of experience accurately measuring public opinion about politics, ballot proposals, and other federal, state, and local issues. Epic MRA is one of the most quoted polling firms in the country. Clients include media outlets, school districts, colleges and universities, state agencies, local governments, labor unions, interest groups, and businesses throughout Michigan. Whether it's measuring voter opinion about who's up or down in elections, or if ballot proposals or legislation can earn voter approval, Epic MRA is known as the go-to Michigan pollster. Visit www.epicmra.com to learn more.
Show your support for preserving our republic at The Republic If You Can Keep It merch store. We've got t-shirts and coffee mugs made to order for lovers of our representative democracy. Just go to our website, arepublicpodcast.com, and click on the merch store button. You aren't fully dressed until you have Ben Franklin on your chest. It's the perfect gift for that democracy lover in your life.
It's an honor to welcome University of Michigan law professor Barbara McQuaid to the podcast this week. Her interests include criminal law, criminal procedure, national security, data privacy, and civil rights. From 2010 to 2017, Professor McQuaid served as the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. She was appointed by President Barack Obama to that position, and she was the first woman to serve in that position.
Professor McQuaid also served as vice chair of the Attorney General's Advisory Committee and co-chaired its Terrorism and National Security Subcommittee. As U.S. Attorney, she oversaw cases involving public corruption, terrorism, corporate fraud, and healthcare fraud, among others. Professor McQuaid also serves as a legal analyst for NBC News and MSNBC. She teaches law at the University of Michigan, where she earned her bachelor's and law degrees.
Welcome, Barb. Thank you for being with us. We really appreciate it. There's so much to talk about, and we want to get your thoughts on. Why don't we start with this great piece that you published just this week about a model prosecution memo, United States versus Donald Trump, where you laid out the law and the facts about how a case could be made for the prosecution of Donald Trump. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your theory and your approach and what you concluded in that memo?
Yeah, will do. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Jeff. Really great to be here with both of you. Appreciate and respect the work that you do. So this is a model of the kind of prosecution memo a DOJ lawyer might prepare for his or her supervisors up the chain of command so that they could see in one place a compilation of the evidence and an assessment of two important questions that prosecutors always have to ask before charges are filed. Number one, do we have sufficient evidence to obtain and sustain on appeal a conviction? That's question one. And then question two, even if we can prove this case, is it in the best interest of justice to file it? And so I endeavored to answer those questions based solely on information in the public domain and focus solely really on one theory, which I think is the cleanest at the moment, though others may emerge, which is Trump's pressure on Mike Pence to abuse his position as vice president to overturn the election results. And I think one thing that's useful about this is, you know, prosecutors will compile oftentimes in a timeline all of the evidence that they have to kind of see whether there are gaps or holes and you can prove the elements of the offense. The two offenses I've suggested here, one is conspiracy to defraud the United States, which is, you know, using fraud to obstruct the lawful operation of government in some way, and obstruction of an official proceeding, which requires some corrupt intent to obstruct, interfere with some government proceeding like a congressional session, like the joint session to count the certification and the votes. Essential to both of those are some acts that a person did to violate those laws. And then the key really is the knowledge and intent, you know, knowledge that in this case, there was not fraud that permitted Joe Biden to steal the election. You'd have to prove that that's true. So the acts are actually pretty easy to prove, I think. Trump did it in broad daylight. He made public statements. He tweeted. He had private meetings with Mike Pence pressuring him to use his position to throw out the vote count and send it back to the states. That part's pretty clear. The part that is really hard is the part about proving that Trump knew it was false. Are you guys Seinfeld fans at all?
Oh, yeah.
Did you ever see the episode where George Costanza is trying to teach Jerry how to cheat and beat a lie detector test? And he says something like, if you believe it, it's not a lie. And so, you know, if Trump has just told himself over and over again, I won the election and there's no way I could have lost unless Biden stole it, it can be really hard to prove that, right? But, you know, you guys probably know from your law school experience and your work as lawyers that proving knowledge can be really challenging. And juries are instructed that because we can never read another person's mind, we have to draw reasonable inferences based on the totality of the circumstances. And so we can look at like things like what the person said and what the person did. And there's also an instruction about willful blindness that says a person can't deliberately ignore the obvious. If there's a high probability of a fact, then we can assume they knew the fact, even if they try to turn a blind eye to it. And, you know, putting together all of the evidence of Trump's knowledge here, it seems to me pretty clear that he had to have known that he did not win this election. And so I document it there. I'll just mention a couple of them. His own DHS cybersecurity chief, Chris Krebs, made an announcement that there was no election fraud. His attorney general, William Barr, made an announcement that there was no widespread election fraud sufficient to overturn the outcome. His own director of national intelligence, John Ratcliffe, said there was nothing in the intelligence community that suggested any interference in the election. Trump's own campaign wrote a memo saying that there was no fraud in the voting machines. They debunked a lot of allegations about, you know, Dominion machines and all of these kinds of things. 61 out of 62 courts rejected Trump's claims about election fraud. And in fact, the only victory he had was over affidavits that did not address the outcome of the election. Even after William Barr resigned, his successors at the Department of Justice told him there was no fraud. They refused to go along with a scheme to try to get the swing states to reverse the outcomes of their elections. And when he persisted in doing that anyway and said he was going to replace the acting attorney general with another person, they stood up to him and threatened a mass resignation unless he backed down. And so all of that says that he knew he didn't win the election. And yet, even on January 6th and after January 6th, he still persisted, insisting that the election had been stolen. So I submit that that is sufficient evidence from which a reasonable jury could infer that he did know he did not win the election. You know, a great analogy I've seen a great lawyer argue in court, it was my husband, by the way, was this. You may insist that the world is flat, and you may say, I know the world is flat. But at some point, after all the scientists tell you that the world is round, and you see pictures from outer space showing that the world is round, at some point, you have to believe that the world is round. And the jury can infer that even if you continue to say you believe the world is flat, that you are just exercising willful blindness to the outcome that you want.
And I mean, when you got somebody who's like a registered super genius, you know, who can remember things like person, man, woman, camera, TV, hard to, you know, I mean, although, you know, I've made the case and many others have that his brain is a, you know, a blob of tapioca pudding. He still knows reality from.
Yeah.
From he's, fiction.
He's not only a genius, Jeff, he's a very stable genius.
Right. Stable genius. That's what it is.
Barb, if I can, I just want to ask a kind of a follow up. So if this criminal prosecution were brought, Trump was found guilty, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt because it's criminal. Would this be something, and again, if I'm going beyond what we know about, this be something that could invoke that Section 3 of the 14th Amendment that says you're then ineligible to hold federal office in the future?
Yeah, super interesting question, Mark. You know, the tricky part of that provision in the 14th Amendment, as I'm sure you know, which is probably why you're asking me the question, is it's really unclear both what amounts to that standard and right. Also how you prove it. So do you have to be convicted criminally? Is it a congressional finding? The answer is I don't know. But it would seem that if anything comes close to that standard, this has to be it. So I think the way you would do it is to get that question to be ripe, he'd have to be convicted, serve his sentence, I suppose, and then run for president, get on the ballot somewhere, and then someone have to sue and say, you're not eligible because of your conviction for conspiracy to defraud the United States over the lawful transition of presidential power. And then a court would decide, I guess, whether
right.
that has been met, and it would work its way up to the Supreme Court, and they would say, yes, this is enough, or no, it's not. I would have to think the answer is yes to that. That's a pretty extreme instance. But, you know, thankfully, we have not really been down this road before in our nation's history. You know, sometimes I tell my students, Mark, there's a famous quote by the head of the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office who said, you know, pretty soon we're going to have to shut down business because all the patents and trademarks, you know, all the great inventions have already been thought of. And he made that quote in 1900, you know, of course, before we had, you know, planes and telephones and televisions and certainly smartphones. And so he clearly missed the mark. And in the same way, you know, sometimes it seems like all the law has already been settled. But we are, in fact, a very young country. And thankfully, we have not had to go down this road before. But maybe we will. And maybe we will get some clarity on what that provision means.
Yeah, there's one thing the 2020 elections taught us is that, yeah, we have not exhausted all the election law issues.
You ain't seen nothing yet. Yeah, well, you're an election lawyer, Mark. You've spent your whole career doing this. Have you been surprised by some of the things you've seen?
Yes. I mean, you know, it used to be, and you all know this, but that, you know, post-election, right? Nobody paid attention, right? The canvassing boards did their work. Nobody knew. And so now it's like there's prior to the election legal proceedings, and then there's the post-election legal proceedings. It's nuts.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what, since Bush v. Gore, maybe that's been...
Started that, but it just got, you know, much more intense in 2020.
Yeah, well, job security for you election lawyers, I'm afraid.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're to the point now where campaign plans include now the post-election phase, not just the, okay, if things are close enough for a recount, what do we do kind of thing, but it's now there's like a whole optics and PR and communications phase that has to be planned for. That just doesn't make sense. Litigating the case after the jury has rendered a verdict and it's been read, the jury's going to go back into the room and the judge is going to sit down again. That's kind of the way that 2020 worked out. Republicans are trying to set up for the next time. They want to get the people in place that will do what the people who were there in 2020 wouldn't do. I mean, thank God we had people like Brad Raffensperger or Aaron. Yeah. There's just, you know, there were so many points where, you know, if one domino had fallen, who knows what would have happened. And that's why you see Trump sticking his nose into county canvass appointments, into legislative primaries, into leadership battles in Lansing, the kind of thing that a president has never even dreamt of before. It's looking ahead having those wrenches available to throw in and for, and that's why it's so dangerous. The people who think of January 6th as an episode rather than part of a process, and I think that's the danger that we face it was just a day in a long battle that the anti-democratic forces are willing to wage.
Yeah, I think you need to take the long view on this and ensure integrity at every stage of the election process. You know, as we saw here in Michigan, there were some really tough moments for people who are on these canvassing boards, and even our state legislature, where there was pressure applied to, replace the slate of electors. And so everybody at every step of the process plays a very important role. I think in one way that is a bit of a safeguard is that we have this decentralized election system. I don't know if you would agree with that, Jeff or Mark. It's difficult to throw the whole election because there's really 50 elections, and that helps a little bit. But, you know, if they're playing the long game, then if you corrupt all 50 states or all of those strategic places where swing elections occur, then, you know, you could really throw some I don't want to say mischief, that's too soft of a word, some corrosion into the system.
And you really sabotage it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm one of the people who actually...
Go ahead, Jeff.
Well, I've served as a county canvasser before, and I've served on the state board. I've been a practitioner of campaigns and run a major state party. You gave me a distinction I haven't earned being an attorney. I'm not an attorney. I just, as Mark knows, I like to pretend I'm one.
That's okay.
On a lot of occasions.
There are attorneys and there are humans. You're in good
Right. But there's, you know, what they're looking at doing is it's not being able to, they don't even need to be successful. And I think they're smart enough to know that. What they need to do is throw a wrench in, say, the certification of Wayne County or Macomb County. And it, you know, if you have to then compel the canvassers to certify the election, if you have to go through that process of a judge or a panel of judges making it happen, that's just further erosion. It plays into the optics, the narrative that they're looking that this is the, you know, the deep state. It lessens the confidence in the results, and that's what they're trying to create, that instability in the future to allow them to effectively seize power, and that's what they tried to do in 2020. I think, you know, the more and more evidence that comes to light shows the breadth of the conspiracy, the depth of the conspiracy, and the fact that it was a bunch of clowns trying to implement it doesn't make it any less of a threat or a crime.
Yeah, and just to finish the point, I know you probably want to move on to some other topics. You know, the second point of my memo is it isn't just you're not done just because you can charge and prove an offense. The second question is, you know, should you file those charges? And there are a lot of reasons not to file charges against Donald Trump. You know, I don't think we want to get into the business of each administration criminally charging their predecessor. I think we want to give presidents a lot of room to say things and to campaign and to exercise free speech. But on the other hand, we have somebody who deliberately tried to overturn the election in a country he wants to lead, to completely subvert our democracy. You know, sometimes we say we have a democracy in peril or a crisis, a constitutional crisis. This absolutely was. This was an effort to obstruct the peaceful transition of presidential power. I mean, that is breathtaking. And so despite all of those potential negative consequences of bringing criminal charges, I think declining to bring them is even worse, because if you want to deter others from doing this in the future, you have to hold wrongdoers accountable. And that's why I think Donald Trump needs to be held accountable.
Well, if I could switch topics, there is another lawsuit pending in Washington in federal court trying to hold Donald Trump and others accountable on the civil side.
Yeah.
Right? And the judge last week refused to dismiss the lawsuit. It's brought under what's called the Klan Act, and which was one of the after effects of the Civil War. I was wondering if you could just tell our listeners a little bit about the Klan Act and about this lawsuit that's trying to hold Trump accountable in a different way.
Yeah, you know, it's really fascinating, Mark, and I think it could succeed even where criminal charges might not, in part because the legal standard in a civil case is only preponderance of the evidence, as opposed to guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And instead of a jury having to find unanimously, they only need to find a majority of a jury needs to find liability in a civil case. So for many reasons, a civil case could be a preferable vehicle to holding Trump accountable. But the Klan Act essentially has evolved and is the statute that gets used whenever government officials abuse someone's constitutional rights. So it's used against police officers from time to time for unlawful beatings and searches and seizures and other kinds of things. And so this is brought by members of Congress who said that Trump conspired with others, including the rioters themselves, the insurrectionists themselves, to unleash this storming of the Capitol that caused them to flee, risk their lives, caused serious monetary damages to the building, and the loss of lives. And it's actually a pretty compelling theory. You know, the immediate motion that was on the table was whether Trump could be dismissed from the lawsuit because he enjoys immunity for acts taken in his office as president. And what the judge wrote was he wasn't acting as president. This was well outside the scope of his duties as president. This was his act as a candidate. He was campaigning to seek a second term in office. And so he allowed the case to go forward. It will next proceed to the discovery phase, where the parties will be permitted to obtain documents and deposition testimony from everyone involved. So it could be really interesting to see what comes out. And also what's interesting is evidence that comes out there could also be used in a criminal case. So some of these things that are happening, it's kind of like a parallel track effort between the January 6th committee, the civil cases, and if there is one, any criminal case. And so criminal investigators could be the beneficiary of all of these other efforts.
If there's anybody who could turn perjury into a capital crime, it's Donald Trump.
Is there any time limit on bringing the criminal case that you described earlier, Barb?
I would think it would be 5 years from the time the crimes were committed. You know, depending on how you frame a conspiracy, you can reach back to the last event that occurred in the conspiracy. So the fact that Donald Trump is still saying that he won the election and it was stolen by Biden, I would say every time he does that, it restarts the clock. So he's, as is often the case, is his own worst enemy there. So I think, 5 years from, 5 minutes from now when he says it again.
Right. So that's still there. Well, and also, too, there's just so much going on. You know, we've got these New York investigations. I think there's two. I think there's one by the New York County District Attorney, and I think there's a state-level investigation going on as well. But can you shed any light on those for us and what may come of those investigations?
It's really interesting, Mark, and it seems like the news in that case changes every day. So, last week there was some fairly significant news when the judge in the state investigation, this is a civil investigation by the Attorney General there, Letitia James, into fraud relating to the assessed values of properties belonging to the Trump Organization. In seeking depositions in that case, she filed a document that was very interesting, more than 100 pages long, where she laid out all of the evidence that she has to date. And on its face, it looks pretty egregious. She alleged things like, in 1 year, we see that the Trump Organization assessed a property to be valued at $200 million. And the very next year, they assessed the very same property to be assessed at $400 million. That's a huge, huge increase in 1 year. There was also document in which Donald Trump estimated the size of his Manhattan apartment in Trump Tower at 30,000 square feet, when in fact, in other documents, it is said that it is 10,000 square feet. Now, that's something that is objectively measurable. And so these things on their face do suggest perhaps some fraud in the valuation of these assets. And it matters because he would use them, as Michael Cohen, his former lawyer, testified before Congress. What he said there that provided a lead for all of this is that when it suited him, Donald Trump would inflate the value of his property. For example, when he wanted to obtain a loan, he would say his property was worth far more than it was. And then he would deflate it when the time came to pay taxes. Or he would inflate it when he wanted insurance coverage. He would inflate it when he wanted a tax deduction. And so as it suited him, he would raise and lower these things, amounting to, millions of dollars in fraud. So that's the civil case. And then there was this order for the Trumps, Donald Trump, Ivanka Trump, and Donald Trump Jr. to sit for depositions, which could be very revealing. And then shortly after that, his longtime accounting firm, Mazars, wrote a letter that said to the Attorney General that said, now that we look at it a little harder, Madam Attorney General, we realize that all those documents we've put together for the past 10 years are no longer reliable. Really interesting. Now, I don't know if it is because the Attorney General brought some matters to their attention that they were previously unaware of, or this was an effort to cover their own potential liability for things they've gone along with for years. Or, there's also this thought of garbage in, garbage out. If they have gone back and looked at it and they realized that the information they were getting from the Trump Organization was false, then maybe they were duped just like everybody else. But whatever it is a strong suggestion that they no longer believe that Trump's numbers are accurate. And so that suggested to me a pretty strong case. And then meanwhile, as you said, Mark, there is this parallel case going on in the Manhattan District Attorney's office, where the district attorney there has been investigating these same issues, but from a criminal perspective. That is, just a higher mental state that this was criminal fraud that they did this for the purpose of defrauding others to obtain a monetary benefit. Cyrus Vance was the Manhattan District Attorney until December 31st, when his term ended and he was replaced by a successor, Alvin Bragg, who was a respected prosecutor. He worked in the Attorney General's office, in the U.S. Attorney's office for the Southern District of New York, has handled a lot of high-profile financial fraud cases. And then yesterday, the two prosecutors who had been working on this case announced their resignations, which seems really curious. There has been some reporting that Alvin Bragg, the new district attorney, has said he is not impressed by the case. And so there is some speculation that they resigned in protest, that he pulled the plug on the case and they have walked off. I don't know that. We don't know why they left, but I will say it is very odd that two prosecutors would resign on the same day when they're in the middle of a very significant prosecution like this. And so I think we're going to learn more about this in the coming days or weeks. But at the moment, it would appear that maybe that prosecution is in some trouble. And it may very well be that the new prosecutor took a look at it and said, you know, there's this civil investigation going on. That seems adequate. Maybe criminal charges here are an overreach. I don't see the evidence. Maybe we should stand down. That would be, you know, reasonable. I haven't seen the evidence. But, you know, reasonable minds can certainly disagree in good faith about whether charges are present in a case. You know, usually when you want to charge a criminal case, it isn't because you think it's a close call. It's because you think I can convince 12 strangers to find guilt beyond a reasonable doubt unanimously. So the evidence has to be very strong before prosecutors will bring a case. And it may be that Alvin Bragg just doesn't think it's there. But it is interesting and it's very surprising just in light of the recent developments we've seen in the civil case.
Maybe this is asking you to get into state law that you don't have necessarily the expertise in, but would there be anything that would prevent Tish James from transitioning into a criminal case at the state level Manhattan DA turns it down?
I don't know. You know, there has been reporting that they were working together mm-hmm. in tandem. You know, in Michigan, I know that if a state prosecutor asks for help from the attorney general, then they may step into a criminal case. And there are certain instances where they would. I don't know enough about the law of New York. But because of that parallel process, it would seem that if they had the authority to do it, they could get up to speed quickly because they have all of the same evidence. The one thing they don't have is access to grand jury evidence, which is restricted to a criminal case. And so it may be that Alvin Bragg knows things that are exonerating that the attorney general does not know. But I suppose it's possible. I don't know what the law of New York is, if it gives her the jurisdiction to bring a criminal case. But if she thought the evidence was there, then she certainly is well positioned to know that. There's also an investigation occurring in Westchester County, criminal, by the DA there. So I suppose that could lead to criminal charges as well. But it relates only to one property, a particular golf course that is located in Westchester County, which is sort of suburban New York City.
Sure. And then there's, I know we're running out of time, but then there's like potential for state charges in Georgia. You know, maybe Trump ends up on a chain gang in Georgia before any of this ever comes to light in New York. You know, because I know the reports are a grand jury has been seated there and is looking at, election tampering, election fraud. You know, I just need to find 11,000 and change votes, whatever the number was. It sounds like, you know, going back to where we started with the memo, sample memo that you wrote in the course of this conversation, that Trump certainly faces a lot of potential legal peril still, regardless of, now 13 months of the Biden administration having gone by with no federal charges, regardless of news coming out of Manhattan DA's office yesterday, Trump still is looking at a lot of potential criminal and civil activity over the next couple of years.
Yeah, no doubt. And, you know, this Georgia case makes a lot of sense because we've heard that phone call with Donald Trump talking to the Secretary of State there, Brad Raffensperger, where he did say, I need you to find 11,000 votes. And Raffensperger, another person who puts Trump on notice that there is no fraud, tells him that there's no fraud and I can't do anything for you. There's more investigation that needs to go. One phone call alone is not going to make a case. You need to know all about the context. And one thing I would share with your listeners is I know a lot of people have grown frustrated with Attorney General Merrick Garland for not bringing charges against Donald Trump yet. But I emphasize the word yet. It takes far longer than people think to pull together the kind of evidence you need to be bulletproof at a trial, to be able to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Some of the things in my memo come from news reports, and that's not enough. They would want to put the sources in the grand jury and really test that testimony, really push and make sure that what the person is saying is accurate. So it takes time to gather all those records, to memorialize that testimony at the grand jury. And so I don't know whether they are or aren't doing it, but I'm not surprised that we have not yet seen charges.
Well, with that, Barb, we just want to thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us tonight. As I was telling Walt and others before we started, one of the great things about you, you're not only a great lawyer, but you are one of the rare lawyers who can translate complex legal arguments and evidence into plain English.
Oh, thanks. Well, I have to be able to understand it myself, so I got to simplify it for myself.
It's terrific, and I learned a lot tonight. So really, on behalf of myself and Jeff and our listeners, thank you so much for your analysis tonight.
You're welcome. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Jeff, for all you do to educate the public. Much appreciated.
That's our time for this week. Our great thanks to Barbara McQuaid for her expertise.
We'd love to have you be part of the conversation. Send us an email, comments@arepublicpodcast.com.
And if the Republic is still standing, we'll be back in a week. I'm Mark Brewer.
And I'm Jeff Timmer. We'll see you next week.
You can subscribe to A Republic If You Can Keep It on your favorite podcast app. A Republic If You Can Keep It is a production of Michigan Citizens for a Better Tomorrow.